The Potato Elf. 1. Actually, his name was Frederick Dobson. To his friend the Conjurer, he talked about himself thus. There was no one in Bristol who didn't know Dobson, the tailor for children's clothes. I am his son, and am proud of it, out of sheer stubbornness. You should know that he drank like an old whale. Sometime around 1900, a few months before I was born, my gin-soaked dad rigged up one of those waxwork cherubs, you know, sailor suit with a lad's first long trousers, and put it in my mother's bed. It's a wonder the poor thing did not have a miscarriage. As you can well understand, I know all this only by hearsay. Yet if my kind informers were not liars, this is apparently the secret reason I am... And Fred Dobson, in a sad and good-natured gesture, would spread out his little hands. The conjurer, with his usual dreamy smile, would bend down, pick up Fred like a baby, and, sighing, place him on the top of a wardrobe, where the potato elf would meekly roll up and start to sneeze softly and whimper. He was 20, and weighed less than 50 pounds, being only a couple of inches taller than the famous Swiss dwarf Zimmermann, dubbed Prince Balthazar. Like friend Zimmermann, Fred was extremely well-built, and had there not been those wrinkles on his round forehead and at the corners of his narrowed eyes, as well as a rather eerie air of tension, as if he were resisting growth, our dwarf would have easily passed for a gentle 8-year-old boy. His hair, the hue of damp straw, was sleeked down and evenly parted by a line which ran up the exact middle of his head to conclude a cunning agreement with its crown. Fred walked lightly, had an easy demeanor, and danced rather well, but his very first manager deemed it wise to weight the notion of elf with a comic epithet upon noticing the fat nose inherited by the dwarf from his plethoric and naughty father. The potato elf, by his sole aspect, aroused a storm of applause and laughter throughout England, and then in the main cities of the continent. He differed from most dwarfs in being of a mild and friendly nature. He became greatly attached to the miniature pony Snowdrop, on which he trotted diligently around the arena of a Dutch circus, and in Vienna he conquered the heart of a stupid and glum giant hailing from Omsk by stretching up to him the first time he saw him, and pleading like an infant to be taken up in nurse's arms. He usually performed not alone. In Vienna, for example, he appeared with a Russian giant and minced around him, neatly attired in striped trousers and a smart jacket with a voluminous roll of music under his arm. He brought the giant's guitar. The giant stood like a tremendous statue and took the instrument with the motions of an automaton. A long frock coat that looked carved out of ebony, elevated heels, and a top hat with a sheen of columnar reflections increased the height of the stately 350-pound Siberian. Thrusting out his powerful jaw, he beat the strings with one finger. Backstage, in womanish tones, he complained of giddiness. Fred grew very fond of him, and even shed a few tears at the moment of separation, for he rapidly became accustomed to people. His life, like a circus horse's, went round and round with smooth monotony. One day, in the dark of the wings, he tripped over a bucket of house paint and mellowly plopped into it, an occurrence he kept recalling for quite a long while as something out of the ordinary. In this way the dwarf traveled around most of Europe and saved money and sang with a castrato-like silvery voice, and in German variety theaters the audience ate thick sandwiches and candied nuts on sticks, and in Spanish ones sugared violets and also nuts on sticks. The world was invisible to him. There remained in his memory the same faceless abyss laughing at him, and afterwards, when the performance was over, the soft, dreamy echo of a cool night that seems of such a deep blue when you leave the theater. Upon returning to London he found a new partner in the person of Shock, the conjurer. Shock had a tuneful delivery, slender, pale, virtually ethereal hands, and a lick of chestnut-brown hair that came down on one eyebrow. He resembled a poet more than a stage magician, and demonstrated his skill with a sort of tender and graceful melancholy, without the fussy patter characteristic of his profession. The potato elf assisted him amusingly, and at the end of the act would turn up in the gallery with a cooing exclamation of joy, although a minute before everyone had seen Shock lock him up in a black box right in the middle of the stage. All this happened in one of those London theaters where there are acrobats soaring in the tinkle and shiver of the trapezes, and a foreign tenor, a failure in his own country, singing barcaroles, and a ventriloquist in naval uniform, and bicyclists, and the inevitable clown eccentric shuffling about in a minuscule hat and a waistcoat coming down to his knees. 2. Latterly, Fred had been growing gloomy and sneezing a lot, soundlessly and sadly, like a little Japanese spaniel. While not experiencing for months any hankering after a woman, the virginal dwarf would be beset now and then by sharp pangs of lone, amorous anguish, which went as suddenly as they came, and again, for a while, he would ignore the bare shoulders showing white beyond the velvet boundary of loges, as well as the little girl acrobats, or the Spanish dancer whose sleek thighs were revealed for a moment when the orange-red curly fluff of her nether flounces would whip up in the course of a rapid swirl. "What you need is a female dwarf," said Shock, pensively, producing with a familiar flick of finger and thumb a silver coin from the ear of the dwarf, whose little arm went up in a brushing-away curve as if chasing a fly. That same night, as Fred, after his number, snuffling and grumbling in bowler and tiny topcoat, was toddling along a dim backstage passage, a door came ajar with a sudden splash of gay light, and two voices called him in. It was Zita and Arabella, sister acrobats, both half-undressed, suntanned, black-haired, with elongated blue eyes. A shimmer of theatrical disorder and the fragrance of lotions filled the room. The dressing table was littered with powder puffs, combs, cut-glass atomizers, hairpins in an ex-chocolate box, and rouge sticks. The two girls instantly deafened Fred with their chatter. They tickled and squeezed the dwarf, who, glowering and empurpled with lust, rolled like a ball in the embrace of the bare-armed teases. Finally, when frolicsome Arabella drew him to her and fell backward upon the couch, Fred lost his head and began to wriggle against her, snorting and clasping her neck. In attempting to push him away, she raised her arm, and slipping under it, he lunged and glued his lips to the hot, pricklish hollow of her shaven axilla. The other girl, weak with laughter, tried in vain to drag him off by his legs. At that moment the door banged open, and the French partner of the two aerialists came into the room wearing marble-white tights. Silently, without any resentment, he grabbed the dwarf by the scruff of the neck. All you heard was the snap of Fred's wing collar as one side broke loose from the stud, lifted him in the air, and threw him out like a monkey. The door slammed. Shock, who happened to be wandering past, managed to catch a glimpse of the marble bright arm, and of a black little figure with feet retracted in flight. Fred hurt himself in falling, and now lay motionless in the corridor. He was not really stunned, but had gone all limp, with eyes fixed on one point and fast chattering teeth. "Bad luck, old boy," sighed the conjurer, picking him up from the floor. He palpated with translucent fingers the dwarf's round forehead and added, "I told you not to butt in. Now you got it. A dwarf woman is what you need." Fred, his eyes bulging, said nothing. "You'll sleep at my place tonight," decided Shock, and carried the potato elf toward the exit. 3. There existed also a Mrs. Shock. She was a lady of uncertain age, with dark eyes which had a yellowish tinge around the iris, her skinny frame, parchment complexion, lifeless black hair, a habit of strongly exhaling tobacco smoke through her nostrils, the studied untidiness of her attire and hairdo. All this could hardly attract many men, but, no doubt, was to Mr. Shock's liking, though actually he never seemed to notice his wife, as he was always engaged in imagining secret devices for his show, always appeared unreal and shifty, thinking of something else when talking about trivialities, but keenly observing everything around him when immersed in astral fancies. Nora had to be constantly on the lookout, since he never missed the occasion to contrive some small, inutile, yet subtly artful deception. There had been, for instance, that time when he amazed her by his unusual gluttony. He smacked his lips juicily, sucked chicken bones clean, again and again heaped up food on his plate. Then he departed after giving his wife a sorrowful glance, and a little later the maid, giggling into her apron, informed Nora that Mr. Schock had not touched one scrap of his dinner, and had left all of it in three brand-new pans under the table. She was the daughter of a respectable artist who painted only horses, spotty hounds, and huntsmen in pink coats. She had lived in Chelsea before her marriage, had admired the hazy Thames sunsets, taken drawing lessons, gone to ridiculous meetings attended by the local bohemian crowd, and it was there that the ghost-gray eyes of a quiet, slim man had singled her out. He talked little about himself and was still unknown. Some people believed him to be a composer of lyrical poems. She fell headlong in love with him. The poet absent-mindedly became engaged to her, and on the very first day of matrimony explained with a sad smile that he did not know how to write poetry, and there and then, in the middle of the conversation, he transformed an old alarm clock into a nickel-plated chronometer, and the chronometer into a miniature gold watch which Nora had worn ever since on her wrist. She understood that, nevertheless, Conjurer Schock was, in his own way, a poet, only she could not get used to his demonstrating his art every minute, in all circumstances. It is hard to be happy when one's husband is a mirage, a peripatetic legerdemain of a man, a deception of all five senses. 4. She was idly tapping a fingernail against the glass of a bowl in which several goldfish that looked cut out of orange peel breathed and fin-flashed when the door opened noiselessly. And Schock appeared, silk hat askew, strand of brown hair on his brow, with a little creature all screwed up in his arms. "Brought him," said the conjurer with a sigh. Nora thought fleetingly, "Child, lost, found." Her dark eyes grew moist. "Must be adopted," softly added Schock, lingering in the doorway. The small thing suddenly came alive, mumbled something, and started to scrabble shyly against the conjurer's starched shirt front. Nora glanced at the tiny boots and chamois spats, at the little bowler. "I'm not so easy to fool," she sneered. The conjurer looked at her reproachfully. Then he laid Fred on a plush couch and covered him with a lap robe. "Blondinette roughed him up," explained Schock, and could not help adding, "bashed him with a dumbbell, right in the tummy." And Nora, kind-hearted as childless women frequently are, felt such an especial pity that she almost broke into tears. She proceeded to mother the dwarf. She fed him, gave him a glass of port, rubbed his forehead with eau de cologne, moistened with it his temples and the infantine hollows behind his ears. Next morning, Fred woke up early, inspected the unfamiliar room, talked to the goldfish, and after a quiet sneeze or two, settled on the ledge of the bay window like a little boy. A melting, enchanting mist washed London's gray roofs. Somewhere in the distance an attic window was thrown open, and its pane caught a glint of sunshine. The horn of an automobile sang out in the freshness and tenderness of dawn. Fred's thoughts dwelt on the previous day. The laughing accents of the girl tumblers got oddly mixed up with the touch of Mrs. Schock's cold, fragrant hands. At first he had been ill-treated, then he had been caressed. And, mind you, he was a very affectionate, very ardent dwarf. He dwelt in fancy on the possibility of his rescuing Nora some day from a strong, brutal man resembling that Frenchman in white tights. Incongruously, there floated up the memory of a 15-year-old female dwarf with whom he appeared together at one time. She was a bad-tempered, sick, sharp-nosed little thing. The two were presented to the spectators as an engaged couple, and, shivering with disgust, he had to dance an intimate tango with her. Again, a lone klaxon sang out and swept by. Sunlight was beginning to infuse the mist over London's soft wilderness. Around 7:30, the flat came to life. With an abstract smile, Mr. Shock left for an unknown destination. From the dining room came the delicious smell of bacon and eggs. With her hair done anyhow, wearing a kimono embroidered with sunflowers, appeared Mrs. Shock. After breakfast, she offered Fred a perfumed cigarette with a red-petaled tip and, half-closing her eyes, had him tell her about his existence. At such narrative moments, Fred's little voice deepened slightly. He spoke slowly, choosing his words, and strange to say, that unforeseen dignity of diction became him. Bent-headed, solemn, and elastically tense, he sat sideways at Nora's feet. She reclined on the plush divan, her arms thrown back, revealing her sharp, bare elbows. The dwarf, having finished his tale, lapsed into silence but still kept turning this way and that, the palm of his tiny hand, as if softly continuing to speak. His black jacket, inclined face, fleshy little nose, tawny hair, and that middle parting, reaching the back of his head, vaguely moved Nora's heart. As she looked at him through her lashes, she tried to imagine that it was not an adult dwarf sitting there, but her non-existent little son in the act of telling her how his schoolmates bullied him. Nora stretched her hand and stroked his head lightly. And at that moment, by an enigmatic association of thought, she called forth something else, a curious, vindictive vision. Upon feeling those light fingers in his hair, Fred at first sat motionless, then began to lick his lips in feverish silence. His eyes, turned askance, could not detach their gaze from the green pompon on Mrs. Shock's slipper, and all at once, in some absurd and intoxicating way, everything came into motion. 5. On that smoke-blue day, in the August sun, London was particularly lovely. The tender and festive sky was reflected in the smooth spread of the asphalt. The glossy pillar boxes glowed crimson at the street corners. Through the gobelin green of the park, cars flashed and rolled with a low hum. The entire city shimmered and breathed in the mellow warmth, and only underground, on the platforms of the tube, could one find a region of coolness. Every separate day in the year is a gift presented to only one man, the happiest one. All other people use his day to enjoy the sunshine or berate the rain, never knowing, however, to whom that day really belongs, and its fortunate owner is pleased and amused by their ignorance. A person cannot foreknow which day exactly will fall to his lot, what trifle he will remember forever. The ripple of reflected sunlight on a wall bordering water, or the revolving fall of a maple leaf. And it often happens that he recognizes his day only in retrospection, long after he has plucked and crumpled and chucked under his desk the calendar leaf with the forgotten figure. Providence granted Fred Dobson, a dwarf in mouse-gray spats, the merry August day in 1920, which began with the melodious hoot of a motor horn and a flash of a casement swung open in the distance. Children coming back from a walk told their parents, with gasps of wonder, that they had met a dwarf in a bowler hat and striped trousers, with a cane in one hand and a pair of tan gloves in the other. After ardently kissing Nora goodbye, she was expecting visitors, the potato elf came out on the broad, smooth street, flooded with sunlight, and instantly knew that the whole city had been created for him and only for him. A cheerful taxi driver turned down with a resounding blow the iron flag of his meter. The street started to flow past, and Fred kept slipping off the leathern seat while chuckling and cooing under his breath. He got out of the Hyde Park entrance and, without noticing the looks of curiosity, minced along by the green folding chairs, by the pond, by the great rhododendron bushes, darkling under the shelter of elms and lindens, above a turf as bright and bland as billiard cloth. Riders sped past, lightly going up and down on their saddles, the yellow leather of their leggings creaking, the slender faces of their steeds springing up, their bits clinking, and expensive black motor cars with a dazzling glitter of wheeled spokes progressed sedately over the ample lacework of violet shade. The dwarf walked, inhaling the warm whiffs of benzene, the smell of foliage that seemed to rot with the overabundance of green sap, and twirled his cane and pursed his lips as if about to whistle. So great was the sense of liberation and lightness overwhelming him. His mistress had seen him off with such hurried tenderness, had laughed so nervously, that he realized how much she feared that her old father, who always came to lunch, would begin to suspect something if he found a strange gentleman in the house. That day he was seen everywhere, in the park where a rosy nurse in a starched bonnet offered him, for some reason, a ride in the pram she was pushing, and in the halls of a great museum, and on the escalator that slowly crept out of rumbling depths where electric winds blew among brilliant posters, and in an elegant shop where only men's handkerchiefs were sold, and on the crest of a bus, where he was hoisted by someone's kind hands. And after a while he became tired. All that motion and glitter dazed him. The laughing eyes staring at him got on his nerves, and he felt he must ponder carefully the ample sensation of freedom, pride, and happiness which kept accompanying him. When finally a hungry Fred entered the familiar restaurant where all kinds of performers gathered and where his presence could not surprise anyone, and when he looked around at those people, at the old dull clown who was already drunk, at the Frenchman, a former enemy, who now gave him a friendly nod, Mr. Dobson realized with perfect clarity that never again would he appear on the stage. The place was darkish, with not enough lamps lit inside and not enough outside day filtering in. The dull clown resembling a ruined banker and the acrobat who looked oddly uncouth and mufti were playing a silent game of dominoes. The Spanish dancing girl, wearing a cartwheel hat that cast a blue shadow on her eyes, sat with crossed legs all alone at a corner table. There were half a dozen people whom Fred did not know. He examined their features, which years of makeup had bleached. Meanwhile, the waiter brought a cushion to prop him up, changed the tablecloth, nimbly laid the cover. All at once, in the dim depths of the restaurant, Fred distinguished the delicate profile of the conjurer, who was talking in undertone to an obese old man of an American type. Fred had not expected to run here into Shock, who never frequented taverns, and in point of fact had totally forgotten about his existence. He now felt so sorry for the poor magician that, at first, he decided to conceal everything. But then it occurred to him that Nora could not cheat anyway, and would probably tell her husband that very evening, "I've fallen in love with Mr. Dobson. I'm leaving you." And that she should be spared a difficult, disagreeable confession, for was he not her knight? And did he not feel proud of her love? Should he not, therefore, be justified in causing her husband pain, no matter the pity? The waiter brought him a piece of kidney pie and a bottle of ginger beer. He also switched on more light. Here and there, above the dusty plush, crystal flowers glowed forth, and the dwarf saw from afar a golden gleam bring out the conjurer's chestnut forelock, and the light and shade shuttle over his tender, transparent fingers. His interlocutor rose, clawing at the belt of his pants and obsequiously grinning, and Shock accompanied him to the cloakroom. The fat American donned a wide-brimmed hat, shook Shock's ethereal hand, and, still hitching up his pants, made for the exit. Momentarily, one discerned a chink of lingering daylight, while the restaurant lamps glowed yellower. The door closed with a thud. "Shock!" called the potato elf, wiggling his short feet under the table. Shock came over. On his way, he pensively took a lighted cigar out of his breast pocket, inhaled, let out a puff of smoke, and put the cigar back. Nobody knew how he did it. "Shock," said the dwarf, whose nose had reddened from the ginger beer, "I must speak to you. It is most important." The conjurer sat down at Fred's table and leaned his elbow upon it. "How's your head? Doesn't hurt?" he inquired indifferently. Fred wiped his lips with a napkin. He did not know how to start, still fearing to cause his friend too much anguish.
"By the way," said Shock, "tonight I appear together with you for the last time. That chap is taking me to America. Things look pretty good."
"I say, Shock," and the dwarf, crumbling bread, groped for adequate words. "The fact is, be brave, Shock. I love your wife. This morning, after you left, she and I, we two, I mean, she..."
"Only I'm a bad sailor," mused the conjurer, "and it's a week to Boston. I once sailed to India. Afterwards, I felt as a leg does when it goes to sleep."
Fred, flushing purple, rubbed the tablecloth with his tiny fist. The conjurer chuckled softly at his own thoughts and then asked,
"You were about to tell me something, my little friend?"
The dwarf looked into his ghostly eyes and shook his head in confusion.
"No, no, nothing. One can't talk to you."
Shock's hand stretched out. No doubt he intended to snip out a coin from Fred's ear, but for the first time in years of masterly magic, the coin, not grasped by the palm muscles firmly enough, fell out the wrong way. He caught it up and rose.
"I'm not going to eat here," he said, examining curiously the crown of the dwarf's head. "I don't care for this place."
Sulky and silent, Fred was eating a baked apple. The conjurer quietly left. The restaurant emptied. The languorous Spanish dancer in the large hat was led off by a shy, exquisitely dressed young man with blue eyes.
"Well, if he doesn't want to listen, that settles it," reflected the dwarf.
He sighed with relief and decided that after all, Nora would explain things better. Then he asked for a notepaper and proceeded to write her a letter. It closed as follows.
"Now you understand why I cannot continue to live as before. What feelings would you experience knowing that every evening the common herd rocks with laughter at the sight of your chosen one? I am breaking my contract, and tomorrow I shall be leaving. You will receive another letter from me as soon as I find a peaceful nook where, after your divorce, we shall be able to love one another, my Nora."
Thus ended the swift day given to a dwarf in mouse-colored spats. 6. London was cautiously darkening. Street sounds blended in a soft, hollow note, as if someone had stopped playing but still kept his foot on the piano pedal. The black leaves of the limes in the park were patterned against the transparent sky like aces of spades. At this or that turning, or between the funereal silhouettes of twin towers, a burning sunset was revealed like a vision. It was Shock's custom to go home for dinner and change into professional tails so as to drive afterwards straight to the theater. That evening, Nora awaited him most impatiently, quivering with evil glee. How glad she was to have now her own private secret. The image of the dwarf himself she dismissed. The dwarf was a nasty little worm. She heard the lock of the entrance door emit its delicate click. As so often happens when one has betrayed a person, Shock's face struck her as new, almost that of a stranger. He gave her a nod and shamefully, sadly, lowered his long-lashed eyes. He took his place opposite her at the table without a word. Nora considered his light gray suit that made him seem still more slender, still more elusive. Her eyes lit up with warm triumph. One corner of her mouth twitched malevolently.
"How's your dwarf?" she inquired, relishing the casualness of her question. "I thought you'd bring him along."
"Haven't seen him today," answered Shock, beginning to eat. All at once he thought better of it, took out a vial, uncorked it with a careful squeak, and tipped it over a glassful of wine. Nora expected with irritation that the wine would turn a bright blue or become as translucent as water, but the claret did not change its hue. Shock caught his wife's glance and smiled dimly.
"For the digestion, just drops," he murmured. A shadow rippled across his face. "Lying as usual," said Nora. "You've got an excellent stomach."
The conjurer laughed softly. Then he cleared his throat in a businesslike way and drained his glass in one gulp.
"Get on with your food," said Nora. "It will be cold."
With grim pleasure, she thought, "Ah, if you only knew. You'll never find out. That's my power." The conjurer ate in silence. Suddenly he made a grimace, pushed his plate away, and started to speak. As usual, he kept looking not directly at her, but a little above her, and his voice was melodious and soft. He described his day, telling her he had visited the king at Windsor, where he had been invited to amuse the little dukes, who wore velvet jackets and lace collars. He related all this with light, vivid touches, mimicking the people he had seen, twinkling, cocking his head slightly. "I produced a whole flock of white doves from my gibus," said Shock. "And the dwarf's little palms were clammy." "And you're making it all up," reflected Nora in brackets.
"Those pigeons, you know, went flying around the queen. She shoo-flied them, but kept smiling out of politeness."
Shock got up, swayed, lightly leaned on the table edge with two fingers, and said, as if completing his story,
"I'm not feeling well, Nora. That was poison I drank. You shouldn't have been unfaithful to me."
His throat swelled convulsively, and, pressing a handkerchief to his lips, he left the dining room. Nora sprang up. The amber beads of her long necklace caught at the fruit knife upon her plate and brushed it off. "It's all an act," she thought bitterly. "Wants to scare me, to torment me. Now, my good man, it's no use. You shall see." How vexing that Shock had somehow discovered her secret. But at least she would now have the opportunity to reveal all her feelings to him, to shout that she hated him, that she despised him furiously, that he was not a person but a phantom of rubber, that she could not bear to live with him any longer, that... The conjurer sat on the bed, all huddled up and gritting his teeth in anguish, but he managed a faint smile when Nora stormed into the bedroom.
"So you thought I'd believe you," she said, gasping. "Oh, no, that's the end. I, too, know how to cheat. You repel me. Oh, you're a laughing stock with your unsuccessful tricks."
Shock, still smiling helplessly, attempted to get off the bed. His foot scraped against the carpet. Nora paused in an effort to think what else she could yell in the way of insult.
"Don't," uttered Shock with difficulty. "If there was something that I... Please, forgive."
The vein in his forehead was tensed. He hunched up still more. His throat rattled. The moist lock on his brow shook, and the handkerchief at his mouth got all soaked with bile and blood.
"Stop playing the fool," cried Nora, and stamped her foot.
He managed to straighten up. His face was wax pale. He threw the bald rag into a corner.
"Wait, Nora. You don't understand. This is my very last trick. I won't do any other."
Again a spasm distorted his terrible shiny face. He staggered, fell on the bed, threw back his head on the pillow. She came near. She looked, knitting her brows. Shock lay with closed eyes and his clenched teeth creaked. When she bent over him, his eyelids quivered. He glanced at her vaguely, not recognizing his wife. But suddenly he did recognize her, and his eyes flickered with a humid light of tenderness and pain. At that instant, Nora knew that she loved him, more than anything in the world. Horror and pity overwhelmed her. She whirled about the room, poured out some water, left the glass on the washstand, dashed back to her husband, who had raised his head and was pressing the edge of the sheet to his lips, his whole body shuddering as he retched heavily, staring with unseen eyes which death had already veiled. Then Nora, with a wild gesture, dashed into the next room, where there was a telephone, and there, for a long time, she joggled the holder, repeated the wrong number, rang again, sobbing for breath and hammering the telephone table with her fist,
and finally, when the doctor's voice responded, Nora cried that her husband had poisoned himself, that he was dying, upon which she flooded the receiver with a storm of tears and, cradling it crookedly, ran back into the bedroom. The conjurer, bright-faced and sleek, in white waistcoat and impeccably pressed black trousers, stood before the pier glass and, elbows parted, was meticulously working upon his tie. He saw Nora in the mirror, and without turning gave her an absent-minded twinkle while whistling softly and continuing to knead with transparent fingertips the black ends of his silk bow. 7. Drowse, a tiny town in the north of England, looked indeed so somnolent that one suspected it might have been somehow mislaid among those misty, gentle-sloped fields, where it had fallen asleep forever. It had a post office, a bicycle shop, two or three tobacconists with red and blue signs, an ancient gray church surrounded by tombstones, over which stretched sleepily the shade of an enormous chestnut tree. The main street was lined with hedges, small gardens, and brick cottages diagonally girt with ivy. One of these had been rented to a certain F. R. Dobson, whom nobody knew except his housekeeper and the local doctor, and he was no gossiper. Mr. Dobson apparently never went out. The housekeeper, a large, stern woman, who had formerly been employed in an insane asylum, would answer the casual questions of neighbors by explaining that Mr. Dobson was an aged paralytic, doomed to vegetate in curtained silence. No wonder the inhabitants forgot him the same year that he arrived in Drowse. He became an unnoticeable presence whom people took for granted, as they did the unknown bishop whose stone effigy had been standing so long in its niche above the church portal. The mysterious old man was thought to have a grandchild, a quiet, fair-haired little boy who sometimes at dusk used to come out of the Dobson cottage with small, timid steps. This happened, however, so seldom that nobody could say for sure that it was always the same child. And, of course, twilight at Drowse was particularly blurry and blue, softening every outline. Thus the uncurious and sluggish Drowsians missed the fact that the supposed grandson of the supposed paralytic did not grow as the years went by, and that his flaxen hair was nothing but an admirably made wig, for the potato wealth started to go bald at the very beginning of his new existence, and his head was soon so smooth and glossy that Anne, his housekeeper, thought at times what fun it would be to fit one's palm over that globe. Otherwise, he had not much changed. His tummy perhaps had grown plumper, and purple veins showed through on his dingier, fleshier nose, which he powdered when dressed up as a little boy. Furthermore, Anne and his doctor knew that the heart attacks besetting the dwarf would come to no good. He lived peacefully and inconspicuously in his three rooms, subscribed to a circulating library at the rate of three or four books, mostly novels, per week, acquired a black, yellow-eyed cat because he mortally feared mice, which bumped about somewhere behind the wardrobe as if rolling minute balls of wood, ate a lot, especially sweetmeats, sometimes jumping up in the middle of the night and pattering along the chilly floor, eerily small and shivery in his long nightshirt, to get, like a little boy, at the chocolate-coated biscuits in the pantry, and recalled less and less frequently his love affair and the first dreadful days he had spent in Drowse. Nevertheless, in his desk, among wispy, neatly folded playbills, he still preserved the sheet of peach-colored notepaper, with a dragon-shaped watermark, scribbled over in an angular, barely legible hand. Here is what it said. Dear Mr. Dobson, I received your first letter, as well as your second one, in which you asked me to come to D. All this, I am afraid, is an awful misunderstanding. Please try to forget and forgive me. Tomorrow my husband and I are leaving for the States and shall probably not be back for quite some time. I simply do not know what more I can write you, my poor Fred. It was then that the first attack of angina pectoris occurred. A meek look of astonishment remained since then in his eyes, and during a number of days afterwards he would walk from room to room,
swallowing his tears and gesturing in front of his face with one trembling, tiny hand. Presently, though, Fred began to forget. He grew fond of the coziness he had never known before, of the blue film of flame over the coals in the fireplace, of the dusty small vases on their own rounded small shelves, of the print between two casements, a St. Bernard dog, complete with barrelette, reviving a mountaineer on his bleak rock. Rarely did he recollect his past life. Only in dream did he sometimes see a starry sky come alive with the tremor of many trapezes while he was being clapped into a black trunk. Through its walls he distinguished Shock's bland sing-song voice, but could not find the trap in the floor of the stage and suffocated in sticky darkness, while the conjurer's voice grew sadder and more remote and melted away. And Fred would wake up with a groan on his spacious bed, in his snug, dark room, with its faint fragrance of lavender, and would stare for a long time, gasping for breath and pressing his child's fist to his stumbling heart, at the pale blur of the window blind. As the years passed, the yearning for a woman's love sighed in him fainter and fainter, as if Nora had drained him of all the ardor that had tormented him once. True, there were certain times, certain vague spring evenings, when the dwarf, having shyly put on short pants and the blonde wig, left the house to plunge into crepuscular dimness, and there, stealing along some path in the fields, would suddenly stop, as he looked with anguish at a dim pair of lovers locked in each other's arms near a hedge, under the protection of brambles in blossom. Presently that, too, passed, and he ceased seeing the world altogether. Only once in a while the doctor, a white-haired man with piercing black eyes, would come for a game of chess, and, across the board, would consider with scientific delight those tiny soft hands, that little bulldoggish face, whose prominent brow would wrinkle as the dwarf pondered a move. 8. 8 years elapsed. It was Sunday morning. A jug of cocoa under a cozy in the guise of a parrot's head was awaiting Fred on the breakfast table. The sunny greenery of apple trees streamed through the window. Stout Anne was in the act of dusting the little pianola on which the dwarf occasionally played wobbly waltzes. Flies settled on the jar of orange marmalade and rubbed their front feet. Fred came in, slightly sleep-rumpled, wearing carpet slippers and a little black dressing gown with yellow frogs. He sat down, slitting his eyes and stroking his bald head. Anne left for church. Fred pulled open the illustrated section of a Sunday paper and, alternately drawing in and pouting his lips, examined at length prize pups, a Russian ballerina folding up in a swan's languishing agony, the top hat and mug of a financier who had bamboozled everyone. Under the table, the cat, curving her back, rubbed herself against his bare ankle. He finished his breakfast, rose, yawning. He had had a very bad night. Never yet had his heart caused him such pain. And now he felt too lazy to dress, although his feet were freezing. He transferred himself to the window nook armchair and curled up in it. He sat there without a thought in his head, and near him the black cat stretched, opening tiny pink jaws. The doorbell tinkled. Dr. Knight, reflected Fred indifferently, and remembering that Anne was out, went to open the door himself. Sunlight poured in. A tall lady, all in black, stood on the threshold. Fred recoiled, muttering and fumbling at his dressing gown. He dashed back into the inner rooms, losing one slipper on the way, but ignoring it, his only concern being that whoever had come must not notice he was a dwarf. He stopped, panting, in the middle of the parlor. No, why hadn't he simply slammed shut the entrance door? And who on earth could be calling on him? A mistake, no doubt. And then he heard distinctly the sound of approaching steps. He retreated to the bedroom, wanted to lock himself up, but there was no key. The second slipper remained on the rug in the parlor. This is dreadful, said Fred under his breath, and listened. The steps had entered the parlor. The dwarf emitted a little moan and made for the wardrobe, looking for a hiding place. A voice that he certainly knew pronounced his name, and the door of the room opened.
"Fred, why are you afraid of me?"
The dwarf, barefooted, black-robed, his pate beaded with sweat, stood by the wardrobe, still holding on to the ring of its lock. He recalled with the utmost clarity the orange-gold fish in their glass bowl. She had aged unhealthily. There were olive-brown shadows under her eyes. The little dark hairs above her upper lip had become more distinct than before, and from her black hat, from the severe folds of her black dress, there wafted something dusty and woeful.
"I never expected,"
Fred slowly began, looking up at her warily. Nora took him by the shoulders, turned him to the light, and with eager, sad eyes examined his features. The embarrassed dwarf blinked, deploring his wiglessness and marveling at Nora's excitement. He had ceased thinking of her so long ago that now he felt nothing except sadness and surprise. Nora, still holding him, shut her eyes, and then, lightly pushing the dwarf away, turned toward the window. Fred cleared his throat and said,
"I lost sight of you entirely. Tell me, how's Shock?"
"Still performing his tricks," replied Nora absently. "We returned to England only a short while ago." Without removing her hat, she sat down near the window and kept staring at him with odd intensity.
"It means that Shock,"
hastily resumed the dwarf, feeling uneasy under her gaze.
"Is the same as ever,"
said Nora, and still not taking her glistening eyes from the dwarf, quickly peeled off and crumpled her glossy black gloves, which were white inside.
"Can it be that she again?"
abruptly wondered the dwarf. There rushed through his mind the fishbowl, the smell of eau de cologne, the green pompons on her slippers. Nora got up. The black balls of her gloves rolled on the floor.
"It's not a big garden, but it has apple trees," said Fred, and continued to wonder inwardly.
"Had there really been a moment when I... Her skin is quite sallow. She has a mustache. And why is she so silent?"
"I seldom go out, though,"
said he, rocking slightly back and forth in his seat and massaging his knees.
"Fred, do you know why I'm here?"
asked Nora. She rose and came up to him quite close. Fred, with an apologetic grin, tried to escape by slipping off his chair. It was then that she told him in a very soft voice,
"The fact is, I had a son from you."
The dwarf froze, his gaze fixing a minuscule casement burning on the side of a dark blue cup. A timid smile of amazement flashed at the corners of his lips, then it spread and lit up his cheeks with a purplish flush.
"My son."
And all at once he understood everything, all the meaning of life, of his long anguish, of the little bright window upon the cup. He slowly raised his eyes. Nora sat sideways on a chair and was shaking with violent sobs. The glass head of her hatpin glittered like a teardrop. The cat, purring tenderly, rubbed itself against her legs. He dashed up to her. He remembered a novel, read a short while ago.
"You have no cause," said Mr. Dobson. "No cause whatever for fearing that I may take him away from you. I am so happy."
She glanced at him through a mist of tears. She was about to explain something, but gulped, saw the tender and joyful radiance with which the dwarf's countenance breathed, and explained nothing. She hastened to pick up her crumpled gloves.
"Well, now you know. Nothing more is necessary. I must be going."
A sudden thought stabbed Fred. Acute shame joined the quivering joy. He inquired, fingering the tassel of his dressing gown,
And what is he like? He is not..."
"Oh, on the contrary," replied Nora rapidly. "A big boy, like all boys." And again she burst into tears. Fred lowered his eyes.
I would like to see him.
Joyously he corrected himself.
Oh, I understand. He must not know that I am like this. But perhaps you might arrange...
Yes, by all means, said Nora hurriedly, and almost sharply as she stepped through the hall.
Yes, we'll arrange something. I must be on my way. It's a 20-minute walk to the railway station.
She turned her head in the doorway, and for the last time, avidly and mournfully, she examined Fred's features. Sunlight trembled on his bald head. His ears were of a translucent pink. He understood nothing in his amazement and bliss. And after she had gone, Fred remained standing for a long time in the hallway, as if afraid to spill his full heart with an imprudent movement. He kept trying to imagine his son, and all he could do was to imagine his own self dressed as a schoolboy and wearing a little blonde wig, and by the act of transferring his own aspect onto his boy, he ceased to feel that he was a dwarf. He saw himself entering a house, a hotel, a restaurant, to meet his son. In fancy, he stroked the boy's fair hair with poignant parental pride. And then, with his son and Nora, silly goose to fear he would snatch him away, he saw himself walking down a street, and there... Fred clapped his thighs. He had forgotten to ask Nora where and how he could reach her. Here commenced a crazy, absurd sort of phase. He rushed to his bedroom, began to dress in a wild hurry. He put on the best things he had, an expensive starched shirt, practically new, striped trousers, a jacket made by Resartre of Paris years ago. And as he dressed, he kept chuckling and breaking his fingernails in the chinks of tight commode drawers, and had to sit down once or twice to let his swelling and knocking heart rest. And again he went skipping about the room looking for the bowler he had not worn for years, and at last, on consulting a mirror in passing, he glimpsed the image of a stately, elderly gentleman in smart formal dress, and ran down the steps of the porch, dazzled by a new idea, to travel back with Nora, whom he would certainly manage to overtake, and to see his son that very evening. A broad, dusty road led straight to the station. It was more or less deserted on Sundays, but unexpectedly, a boy with a cricket bat appeared at a corner. He was the first to notice the dwarf. In gleeful surprise, he slapped himself on the top of his bright-colored cap as he watched Fred's receding back and the flicking of his mouse-gray spats. And instantly, from God knows where, more boys appeared, and with gaping stealthiness started to follow the dwarf. He walked faster and faster, now and then looking at his watch and chuckling excitedly. The sun made him feel a little queasy. Meanwhile, the number of boys increased, and chance passers-by stopped to look and wonder. Somewhere afar, church chimes rang forth. The drowsy town was coming to life, and all of a sudden it burst into uncontrollable, long-restrained laughter. The potato elf, unable to master his eagerness, switched to a jog. One of the lads darted in front of him to have a look at his face. Another yelled something in a rude, hoarse voice. Fred, grimacing because of the dust, ran on, and abruptly it seemed to him that all those boys crowding in his wake were his sons, merry, rosy, well-built sons, and he smiled a bewildered smile as he trotted along, puffing and trying to forget the heart breaking his chest with a burning ram. A cyclist, riding beside the dwarf on glittering wheels, pressed his fist to his mouth like a megaphone and urged the sprinter along as they do at a race. Women came out on their porches and, shading their eyes and laughing loudly, pointed out the running dwarf to one another. All the dogs of the town woke up. The parishioners in the stuffy church could not help listening to the barking, to the inciting halloos, and the crowd that kept up with the dwarf continued to grow around him. People thought it was all a capital stunt, circus publicity, or the shooting of a picture. Fred was beginning to stumble. There was a singing in his ears. The front stud of his collar dug into his throat. He could not breathe. Moans of mirth, shouts, the tramping of feet deafened him.
Then, through the fog of sweat, he saw at last her black dress. She was slowly walking along a brick wall in a torrent of sun. She looked back. She stopped. The dwarf reached her and clutched at the folds of her skirt. With a smile of happiness, he glanced up at her, attempted to speak, but instead raised his eyebrows in surprise and collapsed in slow motion on the sidewalk. All around, people noisily swarmed. Someone, realizing that this was no joke, bent over the dwarf, then whistled softly and bared his head. Nora looked listlessly at Fred's tiny body, resembling a crumpled black glove. She was jostled. A hand grasped her elbow.
"Leave me alone," said Nora in a toneless voice. "I don't know anything. My son died a few days ago."